10 strangers playing for up to $1 million. Among them, a saboteur, a traitor, the mole. The winner, the one who answers the question, who is the mole?
All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again in the Patron Zone, kicking off a new season, temporarily taking a break from Survivor bonus episodes with everything that's been going on with Winners at War, I guess, to immediately date this podcast, as we are big fans of doing. Today, we are here to dive into the season premiere of, I feel it is fair to say, a reality franchise that still maintains its status as a cult classic, Dominic. We're here to talk about season one of ABC's The Mole. It's happening. We're doing it. It's the mole time.
Yeah, we are, in fact, kicking it with The Mole. It's not too serious yet, so I don't want The Mole to get his hopes up, but I'm very excited to be having this little dance with The Mole for the next few weeks.
No one's going to understand that reference after like a couple more weeks from now. I won't even understand that.
You dated the podcast for us. You're the one who gave me the impetus for it. But
I thought we were dating, but the podcast thought we were just hanging out on more casual terms.
Not to date this and the next few months of podcasts, at least, any further. But we are currently in global lockdown. And if there was any good time to get a bunch of podcasting done on any kind of realistic schedule, this would be it. So this is finally the test we've all been waiting for, to see if we can finally do it when all is said and done.
Yes, we will see if we pass this test or if the mole, aka Dom, sabotages us. No, it's sometimes it's my fault too, but Dom is definitely the mole in this pairing. So much to be getting to. I feel like we have been talking about the show kind of in passing ever since we've probably since before we started podcasting together, so this has certainly been a long time coming. I guess just briefly add, of course, this is the latest in a series of classic kind of reality seasons we've covered over on the Patron feed. I will be putting this premiere episode up about a week or so after it goes up for the patrons, whenever episode 2 and potentially episode 3 are up on the Patron feed. I will release this premiere podcast on the main feed for people to get a sample of what they may be into. So hi to anyone listening on the main feed. And if you would be so inclined, you can subscribe to get the remainder of these episodes over at patreon.com/DomandColin. But with that out of the way, Dom, let's dive into things. This is, do you think it's, am I just living in a bubble feeling like The Mole is a franchise people still think fondly of quite often?
As and when they do think fondly of it, yes. But this is something that I've noticed, and part of why I wanted to cover this season ahead of a few other things is that for as much as people talk about The Mole, nobody really talks about The Mole. You know, it's one of those things that comes up in lists of forgotten but great reality TV shows, or you're buried in some sub thread in a Reddit thread, you know, way down at the bottom of the screen. Maybe people will mention The Mole from time to time if someone's looking for recommendations. But it gets far too little actual discussion about it for how good it is and for how enthusiastic people seem to be about it at the time. You know, you go back and see the message board threads about The Mole here from the year 2001, when message boards were still in kind of a weird infancy, but even through to some of the later seasons. This is a franchise which the people who were really into reality TV had a soft spot in their hearts for, and that's a big thing to say given how much competition there was even then and is to this day for that title, right? Like, there's so much reality TV. Not all of it is that good, but The Mole seems to have stood the test of time for many people. And I'm hoping that this rewatch will certainly bring back some of that nostalgia for us and for people out there too, who really think fondly for The Mole, but just haven't had an excuse to think about it in quite some time.
Yeah, I ask because I would be fascinated to know what percentage of people hearing us right now, who presumably are not new to the podcast, if they're starting with this one. I'm guessing the percentage is enormous among patrons, that pretty close to every single patron is at least loosely familiar with The Mole. But in terms of just the broader Survivor superfan community, I would say, is the vast majority of our main audience. What percentage of them in the year 2020 do you feel like have no real idea what the mole is or was, RIP?
It's so hard to put a number on that. And I don't know if there are people going back and rewatching, watching for the first time, right? As opposed to they watched it for themselves when, you know, this was 20 years ago. And intermittently since then, they've just tried to rekindle that love for it when they can. But I don't know if the younger generation, the Gen Z of the world, are discovering the mole en masse and falling in love with it.
So I know the mole is not just an American concept. I don't believe it's even originally American. I know it's been very successful internationally in several countries. As recently, at least, I feel like I was seeing when I was finding these episodes on YouTube, international seasons, at least as recent as within the last 6 or 7 years. So I feel like the mole in the global scheme of things is pretty cemented as one of the most successful kind of reality franchises, but in America and maybe in England, Dom, I don't know if they ever did a mole UK. Did they ever do a mole UK that you're aware of?
As with Survivor, they tried to piggyback on its success internationally. They did 2 seasons, they flopped terribly, and no one ever heard of it ever again.
Did it springboard the career of any great British journalists?
Not that I know of, unfortunately. But yeah, the Dutch had Wie's de Mol, which is a long-running franchise, certainly much longer running than the American version. I think they're closing in on 20 seasons now. And they got the idea from the Belgian version of the Mol even before that. So this is something which has been around for a long time, has continued for a long time, and has gained traction internationally. And often some of these shows seem quintessentially American in that they only really could have originated in their current form in the States, and then maybe that causes them to spread out across the world. But in this case, it's almost the reverse, where this seems like a universally appealing or culturally relevant idea, and the States is just picking up on it when they could.
Yeah, I will also add that I'm trying to remember when this would have been. It was certainly a long, long time ago. I watched a couple seasons on YouTube that are probably still on YouTube of the Australian version of The Mole, and there were many seasons of that as well. So I am guessing we may still be missing several countries where The Mole has been immensely popular, but it only did 2 seasons, only 2 seasons with Anderson Cooper, and then one other with a different host and all civilian kind of players and 2 celebrity editions. But I am guessing it has been a long time since many people have seen it, if they've seen it at all. And so even if the bulk of people hearing this episode are probably at least loosely familiar with the premise, Dom, I did think it would be worth going back through and just talking about the game itself and why we feel like it has been such an enduring kind of format. Not in America, it was not nearly as successful as a lot of the other shows that we've covered here, but certainly is something that has found a place in many different parts of the globe. So set up for the people just the basic premise of The Mole.
So the basic premise is you have some number of contestants. I think it's usually in like the 10 to 12 range. And each week or each cycle, they complete in a series of tasks to add money to the total pot. That is usually a winner-takes-all thing, by my understanding. Like the winner takes home whatever the cast has amassed by the end of the season. However, one person, unknown to them, is the mole. And I guess it's unknown in the sense that they all know there is a mole in there, but they don't know who it is, and they have to figure that out for themselves. And whoever's best at doing that stands the best chance of winning the game, because at the end of each round, they answer a series of questions about who they think the mole could be, and the person who is least accurate on that test is eliminated. And that's how we get to a progressively smaller number of people as we build towards the end game. And across the way, the mole is doing their best to sabotage the task and stop the team from adding as much money to that pot as they can. And so the part of the fun of the show, beyond just the tasks are funny or the contestants are good and so on, is trying to figure out for yourself at home who the mole is based on these small scraps of information that that we're given by the producers intentionally to maybe lead us in a certain direction or to put the wall over our eyes.
Right. And I think it is certainly a show that right off the bat is probably like most interesting right away, when the people have as little information on each other as possible. Because while I am absolutely in love with just the fundamental idea behind like the game design of the mole, I do think, I guess we should clarify, actually, I don't think we've said this on air. It is at least our intention to talk through the episode in general, unspoilery terms, in terms of anything going beyond the episode of the week. And then we'll give a warning for the people that do watch ahead, and talk through things from that week's episode with the big picture in mind afterwards. And by the way, all of this season is on YouTube. There are 9 total episodes that are an honest 42 minutes each. It is a clean kind of 6-hour binge. I've done the whole thing already. I'm very much looking forward to going back through it to do some closer note taking for these podcasts. But yeah, it's very easy to find on YouTube. And in plugging the YouTube episodes, I'm now remembering where I was going with that is, I think one kind of issue that they run into in pretty much every season I've seen, not just in America, but as I mentioned, I've seen a couple of the international seasons as well, is when it is human players that are playing face to face and getting to know each other pretty well and are gaining information over the course of the game in terms of, well, I'm still here, at least some of my answers on the elimination quizzes must be going pretty well for me. Pretty much every time, as I'm sure we'll get into at a certain point along the way here, I feel like it is almost a foregone conclusion that the majority of the cast will eventually know with basically absolute certainty who the mole is.
Yeah, I've just been watching season 5 of The Mole in after casting around desperately for something to binge through while we go through this tough time. And one thing that really stood out about that season, among many other things, which hopefully we'll have an excuse to talk about at some point, is that you can hone in on who the mole, not just who you think the mole is, but who the mole basically has to be by the time you get halfway through the season, because literally no one else makes any sense. It is impossible that they would have deliberately chosen any of the other cast members to be the mole, given what the role entails. So you have to pay careful attention to that in casting, that they're, you know, in the worst possible boot order, you still have a bunch of people who could go through the motions of pretending to be the mole, whether it's for in-game reasons of trying to draw suspicion to them and avert it from the person that they think is the actual mole, or just for the sake of making good TV. And, you know, it's possible to make good TV while also eliminating yourself as a potential mole. And that's kind of, it's a similar issue to how we talk about the Survivor having this fundamental flaw of often the best actual gameplay in terms of maximizing your chances is the worst thing for the viewers at home, where you just want to get a solid, stable alliance, build good bonds of trust within that, and ride it to the finish line as fast as you can. That is good, methodically sound Survivor gameplay, and it is boring-ass TV, and you want to avoid that at all costs. And I feel like The Mole has a lot of those tensions baked into its basic premise, where, so for example, you probably want The Mole to be someone who is good at avoiding suspicion when they want to, who can just blend into the background, can go along with a task and do well but not too well, or badly but not too badly, to the point where maybe it seems like a genuine mistake, or maybe they just had a really good day and this is a challenge that they were good at. And you want most people in the cast to be able to fill most of those roles, and so you can't really afford to have these big outliers if you want to keep The Mole's role secret. And you see this in some iterations of The Mole where they almost give up on that premise midway through the season, and it's like, well, okay, you're not actually going to suspect that this person could be the mole. However, they're a big, fun character, so we're going to lean into that as much as we can, knowing that they're either going to be eliminated and crash and burn, and you're going to enjoy watching that happen, or they'll get to the end and they'll either maybe they'll win the game or they'll be the losing finalist. Sometimes compelling, sometimes not. And I guess that question of who actually wins a season, you need that to be interesting too. You want to have a good mix of people in contention for that too. So you have these two different tracks that you need to follow, and they seem to be at cross purposes sometimes.
Right. I think that question of who's going to win the season is the producer's best friend at a certain point in most iterations of The Mole, and it's just unavoidable, I would say, when it is just humans playing against each other and getting such a good feel for each other over the course of an entire season, and just to get into what I would consider just kind of like basic mole theory, I guess, is pretty useful in general to have people wondering if you might be the mole yourself. It is a disadvantage to you if they can rule you out for whatever reason and know that you're not someone they need to be concerned about in terms of answering your way on the quiz. And I guess we should state for anyone unfamiliar, as these rounds go by, they do a couple of tests each round, tasks that the mole does or does not sabotage, and then they're given a quiz. And whoever scores the lowest on the quiz gets the red thumbprint and is eliminated. And the quiz is all about what the mole was up to over the course of that round. But the idea of who might win is, of course, always going to be a lingering question. And what I was getting at, sorry, is the idea of it is useful if you want to be the eventual winner to, at least in a perfect world, have people wondering if you could be the mole too. And a big issue that I think every season, as I've said, kind of runs into is people at a certain point just have like defining like citizen I'm not the mole moments, whether it's something they do in a task or it's something to do with production or whatever it is. There is almost inevitably, and probably without a ton of time passing in most people's cases, going to be something that happens that for an observant player is almost surely going to conclusively rule them out of being the mole.
And it's great to have that incentive in place that people want to be trying to sabotage a task and making these big TV-friendly bloopers in order to draw suspicion to themselves. But I think you do quickly get into this situation where actually it's not the person I most suspect, it's the person I least suspect. And so attention starts to coalesce around these less obviously diabolical players, and it goes on the people who, you know, it's starting to stand out over time that no one has a bad word to say about this person. And once you get to that stage and people have an incentive to try and lie low instead, then that advantage suddenly becomes a disadvantage, and there's not too much you can do about that. And then they're also working within this fundamental constraint of they want to keep the suspense of the mole's identity for the viewers. If that goes away, then it's a different show. And maybe it would still be a very interesting show, right? You can imagine instead of a mole, you have a saboteur where you know who their identity is from day one, and you get to watch them do their best to take down the team, almost like an America's Player kind of thing. I think that would be a fun show to watch too, but that and the mole are two very different shows with two necessarily different formats about them. So in The Mole, you have someone working behind the scenes often to try to derail the task, but as the producers, you can never highlight that too explicitly or really explicitly at all until the very end of the show. And so the best acts of sabotage are often hidden from the audience past the point where some of them may have stopped tuning in out of boredom. Or, you know, if the season starts to stagnate in the middle, but The Mole is doing a great job, that can't really redeem it in any way, because all of that is necessarily hidden from the audience. So it's almost like The Mole doing a good role has to be the cherry on top of an otherwise good season, because otherwise the format just can't work.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll talk along the way about what would go into being an effective mole in any given task. So I don't want to spend a ton of time on...
And Colin, not to... make too much out of this point, but if you compare this to, let's say, The Genius, which has a similar like heist feel to it sometimes, the great thing there is that because each game resets and there's no defined role for the mole, you can choose to be the mole in week one and you come back and play it straight up in week two, they can afford to have these big reveals at the end of the episodes that keep people excited for that big reveal, for that moment of anticipation, because they know there's going to be some angle that they couldn't see. And so when, you know, when the scale falls from their eyes and they see things completely differently, that's really exciting. But for the mole, you get exactly one of those moments, and it's in the finale, which you already hope is going to be this exciting climax of the season anyway. So a lot of what could be great TV content has to be on the cutting room floor. And that, I'm sure that's frustrating for both the mole and also the editors and producers, where you have this great scene which you'd love to include in the episode, but it tips the hand as to who the mole is, and so it's off limits.
Right, there are only 9 episodes in this whole season, and one of them, the 9th, as it turns out, is an entire reunion by itself. And I remember as I was watching these mole seasons in real time, really looking forward to the reunion, because they would always do a montage of all of the behind the scenes of what the mole was doing now that their identity has been revealed and they can come clean about all of their little acts of sabotage. And also along the way, they, for at least the viewing audience, and I don't think many of these were pertinent for the players in real time, they will include some small kind of visual clues about the identity of the mole, and getting to that reunion each season was always exciting for that kind of genius-esque reveal for a young Colin Stone.
Mm-hmm. And in the spoiler zone segments for each episode, we'll talk about those in the episode itself as we encounter them, just to see if there's any actual merit to that, or if this is, after the fact, them trying to suggest not so subtly that of course you could have known the whole time if only you had been paying attention properly.
So one question I've always had, and I don't think the answer exists publicly at least, but I've always wondered what was in it for the mole. I would imagine they were getting some sort of set fee to be in all of the episodes, but the amount that they ended up sabotaging from the group, it's not like that money all goes to them, right? It's not that, that's certainly not made explicitly clear at any point on the show. And it's always just been a question of mine wondering why the mole would at least necessarily feel compelled to go out of their way to sabotage the group at any point if the main goal is keeping their identity a secret.
So my understanding, and this is something which I had to research myself, again, as you said, this is not offered to the audience in terms of necessary information. We're still in this early phase of reality competition shows where it's you know, the audience is kind of kept on this need to know basis, and it's unclear to the audience and also to the producers exactly what they do need to know at any one time. So we show up and we have the concept of the mole explained to us, but this crucial piece of information which is going to determine the entire flow of the game based on the mole's incentive to act in a certain way is left out, and you have to just, I guess while the show was airing, you had to assume it for yourself, or after the fact you get maybe some information coming out then. My understanding is that the mole in this season and through the other civilian seasons of the mole in the US was just paid a stipend for their participation in the show, and right. I imagine it was a handsome sum, and when that person went through casting, I don't think they were casting for the role of the mole. I think they were auditioning for what they assumed this show would be, and then they were made this offer during the casting process. Okay, look, you are going to be on the show as the mole or not at all. You will be paid a fixed sum X for taking part. Are you in or out? And that's the choice they face. So as you say, it's unclear what the incentive is meant to be for the mole to ever actually sabotage the group. And this is especially strong as you get down to the end game, where if the mole has formed like really close friendships with people, or they have this alliance with someone else that they want to take the whole way through, if anything, the mole wants to be doing their sincere best in all of the tasks to try and bloat the prize pot for their friend, for their alliance member who they hope can win in their stead. And if you change that, then you change the entire focus of the mole. So let's say, I think the prize pool in this season was a potential $1 million, yes?
Like I do not know. I did not count up all of the prizes. It wouldn't surprise me if the maximum was $1 million.
Yeah, and that's a good round number to have it be. But either way, there is some theoretical maximum where if everyone does perfectly on every single task and no one bites the apple, as James Cameron would put it, and they all no one gives into temptation, then the winner of the season can get a theoretical X dollars. You could say, as the producers, okay, X dollars is being paid out this season, but who it's being paid out to depends on how successful the mole is. If the mole is able to draw money away from the pot, then the mole gets it. And if the rest of the cast is able to keep it in the pot, then that goes to the eventual winner. In that case, you have this really interesting decision at every point for the mole, where do they do their best to avoid detection and risk their ability to gain money for themselves in future tasks, or do they go for this short-term game, if they find a way to sabotage the current task and get money for themselves, then they're constantly having to weigh up the risk and the reward. And that would be really fun to see. But again, it's hard to do that as well while the mole's identity is concealed from the audience, because there would be so many layers we would be missing. And the entire incentive structure of the show would fundamentally change. But the current one seems somewhat flawed insofar as, if I'm the mole and I'm not like this complete sociopath, I want my friends to do well. And if I am socially skilled enough to be the mole in the first place and to be a good mole, I'm probably going to make some close friends within the game, unless the rest of the cast is completely shitty too. So, you know, as the producers, you need to make the mole work against their most natural human instincts, and you don't give them any actual reason to do that.
Right. At a certain point, I feel like, you know, this is something that they certainly do not bring up in the TV episodes until the reunion. But I would imagine in the vast majority of seasons of The Mole that have ever been filmed in any country, once they're down to like the final four or five people, pretty much everyone is confident in who the mole is, generally speaking. And at a certain point, it does become almost exclusively a question of what kind of person you want to be when you are the mole and clearly the jig is up. And now the question is just, will you continue to put on a show?
I'm sure that every aspect of this plan is strongly frowned upon and probably explicitly forbidden as well. But if I was the mole, I would want to just team up with someone that I liked and trusted and thought could go deep in the game, with the understanding that we would split some portion of the prize money after the show, where I'm going to do everything I can to help them win and to help them win as much money as possible. And I can do that because I have perfect information. So I can subtly or not so subtly drop clues to them about who the mole could be. Even if I can never come out outright and say, hey, I'm the mole, just here's the cheat sheet. And just nudge them from behind the scenes into the limelight, and then I can get my share of the rewards afterwards. And I don't know, and I would not be in a position to know how many people have actually tried that, but if I was the mole, that would be my first impulse, right?
Sure it would, Dom. Yeah. You're all about the spirit of the game, for sure.
But honestly, though, if you're a player in the main game too, by far the best strategy, as far as I can tell, is to find the most likely candidate to be the mole and befriend them. Not just because, even if they keep up their veneer of professionalism, just knowing them better is going to lead to doing better on the quiz in all likelihood, but also because if they are willing to not even engage in some kind of underhanded deal like I would be, but just to, you know, help their friend along, which is the most natural human instinct in the world, then I'm going to directly benefit from that. So I think that is the best, like when we talk about mole strategy, insofar as we even can, that is the most obvious one and the best one. Just find the mole, make them your best friend, and never let them go.
Just get them to tip the entire game to you. I agree. Yes. And I'm sure the producers would love that. To just quickly circle back to the idea of just like incentivizing the mole, would it be a good idea? This crossed my mind, and I don't know if this would or not be a good idea. So you tell me if it would be interesting for any test the group fails, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be by the mole's hand, but just any test they fail, that money goes to the mole, but the mole loses money out of that pot for every question that people get right on the quiz. So you want to sabotage without being noticed.
That could work. I guess it comes down to how much you want contestants' accidental mistakes to influence that distribution of money, because again, this is only sustainable if people are making mistakes, if they fail on a task, or if they chicken out of doing a task, or something goes terribly wrong that's only partially inside their control, and that leads to the team as a whole losing money. But then the question is, do you want them all to benefit from that or not? And if it has to be the mole specifically has to do something to get the money, that needs to be very clearly defined, or else it becomes very murky.
Yeah, it certainly has not been fully thought through by me. I'm sure that's a big surprise. I wouldn't, just in thinking about incentives one direction or another for the mole, for any mole super fans out there who've seen all the international versions, I don't know if this version exists, but I want to see whatever season featured the most blatant mole, who like took the approach of, well, people are going to think that anyone overtly messing up missions is just trying to draw suspicion and could never actually be the mole. So I'm just going to constantly tank everything and people will think it can't be me. I want to see that season, if such a season exists.
You would love to see it, and I would want to see it too. So if anyone has that information, then by all means, point us in that direction.
Like, I want to know how long it takes people to start asking themselves, wait, could it really be this person who's making it so obvious?
Okay, remind me to bring this up when we get to the spoiler section, if you can. But yeah, I
will not be able to remind you to bring that up, by the way.
I will attempt to remind myself, so we'll see if that happens. But yeah, I guess at some point you get into the question of, if they are so bad at every single task, why are they still there? Do they just know something we don't? And are they maybe in a position to know something that we don't? And so people could be onto them that way. But yeah, if you kind of like outthink the leveling war by just being the most blatant mole of all time and just watching people's minds explode as they go round and round in circles, then that would be great, especially if you have the charisma to pull it off.
I think that may be one of the most GTO approaches, Dom, Game Theory Optimal approaches, at least in the early days of casting aside, so what deflecting suspicion is what I'm trying to say. Because at least I would be saying to myself early on, the mole, at least during this opening round or opening couple of rounds, is definitely going to be hanging back and is not going to want to do anything too obvious to pull suspicion their way. So if you're the person just actively tanking everything, that could be the solution to hiding in plain sight, I suppose. But Dom, I'm sure we'll have a lot more just kind of general mole stuff that we've been waiting a decade to talk about come up along the way. I think let's get into some of the specifics in terms of this season in particular that we are going to be watching play out here. And let's take a trip back in time to January 9th, 2001. Dom, actually, don't tell me the answer to this. How old were you on January 9th, 2001? Like four?
Colin, I was a sturdy 8 years old.
Okay, you had just turned... you had just turned nine, right?
No, that's not how years work. I just turned eight.
Yeah, you just turned eight. Damn it. Yeah, so it took me a minute for the dots to connect here, but this is, for anyone who, like me, is bad at math, pre-9/11, which kind of blew my mind. I would have... I don't know... how I would have been arriving at my ballpark guess for when The Mole season one aired. I would have thought it was later than that, though. I would have thought it was like 2003, 2004 at least, when all this was going on. But this is, over the course of the season, I feel, it will demonstrate itself to be kind of pre-9/11. A lot of these missions really do throw caution to the wind. Maybe they would still be equally willing to do so these days. But it is, I think, one of the most interesting kind of parts about the game that as the tests come along, in order to be justifiably sabotageable for the mole, most of the tests have to feature something that people can defensibly claim they could not do or weren't, more to the point, would not be willing to do, is a big part of the missions over the course of the mole. And even some of the things that they end up getting the entire group on board with, the running of the bulls comes to mind, Tom. I don't know if you've gotten to that episode yet, but excited to get there somewhere along the way. There are a lot of things over the course of this season that I feel like reality TV producers would be terrified about in modern times.
Definitely some liability issues there, for sure. And there are some clues that if you didn't know this was filmed pre-9/11 that would tip you off. Like all of the scenes of them just happily sauntering through an airport with no security in sight. Like, not so sure you could replicate that these days. But the role of 9/11 in the progression of pop culture is, you know, a fascinating topic and one which I think is understudied at large. I know that in the context of Survivor, Mario Lanza likes to say that 9/11 sapped a lot of the momentum from the early seasons of Survivor, where after 9/11, regardless of how good any given season was, it could never recapture the heights of the phenomenon that Borneo was.
Sorry.
Yes, thank you. That Borneo was, that Australia was. And you know, you saw this in Africa, and then by the time we get to Marquesas, then the momentum had gone and it was just another TV show, albeit still a very popular one, but it was never going to recapture its former glory in quite the same way. And just in general, I think it changed the mood around the kind of shows that people wanted to watch, and just the entire genre of reality TV seemed a lot more frivolous than it had done pre-9/11. And some shows were affected by this more than others. So season one, episode one, like the first episode ever of The Amazing Race was September 5th, 2001. So there's a pretty big change between episode one and literally every episode after that point. But for the mole, I think just the entire premise maybe has more of a tie-in there than it does too. But I guess for The Amazing Race, the idea of traveling all around the world and paying scarce attention to national borders feels very different in a pre versus post 9/11 world. For the mole, already here in 2000, it's kind of banking on this post Cold War vibe and the premise where like spy shows are really cool and there's this suspicion about people around you, which already was starting to feel a little dated as we get to the year 2000. But post 9/11, that takes on this whole new quality to it.
And it should be mentioned, I don't think we've brought this up yet, that this is not just a bunch of people running around California. They are traveling all over, I guess for this season, for the most part, it is Europe. And Dom, you are going to be the one answering all of the European geography questions. I am going to be failing miserably whenever that comes up. But it is definitely a bigger kind of production than I guess I had remembered. I knew they were certainly traveling around the world, but plenty of these tests ended up being a lot more elaborate, and I would imagine a much higher budget than it feels like many reality TV shows are offered these days.
And yeah, so this season is primarily in Europe. Season 5 goes to South America, and they really do lead into the international aspect of it. And this is at a time when many of the TV shows that were on the air, so Survivor and Big Brother, both focus on this theme of deprivation, right? Where Survivor, they really push it to its extreme. You're out there on an island with none of the essentials that you take for granted in everyday life. Excuse me. And then in Big Brother, you're in this house, which in theory is like comfortable and fully furnished, and you have all the food you want on demand. And it sounds like a student's paradise almost, but you're cut off from the outside world and you don't have any means of communication and so on and so forth. So there's always some kind of explicit limit being put on its contestants as part of the concept. For the mole, they almost go the opposite way. And, you know, they're traveling to all these great international locations and then putting them up in these wonderful hotels. And even though this was long before high definition, you can tell that this was meant to be a big production and that they wanted the contestants to feel like they were in some spy or heist movie, right? Where they're in luxury, but that almost raises the stakes in a way because there's some danger lurking behind every closed door.
Have we watched any patron seasons that were not in 4x3 definition? I guess Heroes versus Villains would be the only one
Yes.
that was not in glorious 4x3.
That honestly might be it. Yeah, we're kicking it old school.
Yeah. So I think when I am thinking just about The Mole as a franchise, this was I wish we had someone who knew the history better in terms of the timeline here. But I know the first two seasons aired, I think, both in 2001. This was in January 2001, and I think the second season either shot in the end of 2001 and filmed in aired in early 2002, or may have even aired itself in the fall calendar there in 2001 as well. But when I think of The Mole, those first two seasons are the real meat of what I enjoyed about this franchise. I know there were, I think, two other celebrity seasons, and then The Mole season 5 was played with civilians again. But for my money, the first two were the ones that really stood out as being like the all-time classic, deserve to be remembered forever in the pantheon of the greatest reality TV seasons that have ever existed. And a big reason for that is the host of The Mole. I'm guessing most people know who this is.
I will jump in to say that Dennis Rodman's season of The Celebrity Mole would also be up there for me, just because it's such
a
mind-bending experience. But yeah, just to fill in the 9/11 context, so season 2 of The Mole made its debut in September 2001.
Yeah.
But here's the Wikipedia entry, quote, "However, after 3 weeks, it was put on hiatus, with disappointing ratings in the wake of 9/11 and the Friday night death slot to blame. The producers later admitted that airing the program on Fridays was, quote, a big mistake. The show returned in June 2002, restarting from the beginning as a summer replacement series on Tuesdays." So, yeah, that's a great case. But there are some other factors in play, too. But 9/11 literally just was this brick wall in the face of the show even airing.
That is interesting, and I did not remember that happening. I really should have read the Wikipedia for The Mole 2 as well. But the big point that I am getting at is, what I think really defines The Mole for me, and a major reason for why I have such fond memories of this franchise, is the truly stellar work that is done by the host here, that even though he was only around, I believe, for the first two seasons of this, which I think only works out to 18 episodes, I know to this day he remains in the conversation, at least when we're having it, for the greatest host in the history of reality TV. And after rewatching this first season of The Mole, I do not feel like that is hyperbolic. Dom, our guide through this season is the now very famous Anderson Cooper, who, by the way, let's lead off the Anderson Cooper conversation where it deserves to be led off. How old do you think Anderson Cooper is as this season is filming? I looked this up.
As the season is filming?
Or as it was, how old would you put Anderson Cooper here?
I would say like 32.
Wow. Anderson Cooper is 33 years old. I thought you were going to say way higher than that. Yeah, I was devastated to find out that Anderson hosting The Mole is 1 year older than I currently am today. But Dom,
He definitely has the reality TV host gene of seemingly never aging a single day in his life. So his age is really up for debate at any given time.
Well, I would actually say, I mean, as someone who has had the news on quite a bit lately, mostly by virtue of a lot of other programming being gone now that the coronavirus has taken over, I have been seeing a lot of Anderson Cooper lately on fake news CNN, and I would say he has actually aged at least somewhat in the last 20 years compared to Jeff Probst. But aging aside, it crossed my mind a couple of days ago, how jealous must Jeff Probst be of Anderson Cooper? Because I'm pretty sure this was like his exact dream of, I'll host Survivor for a little bit, but that will springboard me into becoming a household name.
Did The Mole effectively springboard him, though, or was he an established presence before this?
Because I think being born into the Vanderbilt family was a pretty solid springboard.
So really, Jeff, like the rest of us, wishes he had been born into the Vanderbilt family.
Yes.
I think is the real takeaway there.
Very big oversight on Jeff's part.
But in terms of his burgeoning TV career, as far as I know, Anderson Cooper was already like a news anchor, and not maybe a household name unless you watch his broadcast every night, but he was at least a familiar face to a lot of people, whereas Jeff was still like slamming it on Rock and Roll Jeopardy and trying to find a more permanent gig, and the best gig he could ask for realistically landed in his lap, and he made the most of it, and he himself is now a household name. But I don't think that he and Anderson were really on the same trajectory at the time they picked up their respective jobs, and Anderson's prior TV hosting experience really shines through here, where it all feels so completely seamless to him.
Yeah, Anderson is extremely good. I would liken Anderson Cooper to like a John Mulaney in the world of comedy, or like a Field Yates in the world of the NFL, where they were, without a doubt, only able to get into the positions that they got into at such early ages exclusively because of the families that they were born into. But once put into those positions, they absolutely crushed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like playing the hand you're dealt, and sometimes you have aces, and sometimes, you know, like it's a question of doing the best with what you have, and Anderson certainly did, even though if TV didn't work out, he could very easily just waltz his way into anything else because of his money and be just all right. So,
no, I mean, if anything, it's kind of like Julia Louis-Dreyfus was born into, I think, literally billions of dollars, but has continued an incredible career that I would put up against pretty much any other actor in the history of sitcoms. I mean, that resume is unbelievable. And I think it's kind of a testament to the Andersons and Julia's Louis-Dreyfuses of the world that they feel compelled to keep going out there and doing their own thing.
Honestly, if I was born into obscene wealth, no one would ever know my name because I would just be relaxing on my own private island somewhere for the rest of my life.
Now would be the time for your own private island.
Absolutely, yeah. No one else can come in, no one else can go out. I'm just there in a solitary bubble by myself. But I do think Anderson is not just a good host, but he works well given what the show is, because he has this kind of like carefully cultivated air of mystery about him.
Yes.
Right? Where if he was... like, Arisa Cox, for instance, I think now is a great host for Big Brother
Thank
Canada.
You for coming around, yes, Tom, look, after hating Arisa.
But I don't know how well it would work out for her on The Mole, where, you know, she's, like, very exuberant and tries to have this really close rapport with the contestants. I think for a thing like The Mole, you want the host to be somewhat remote and a little mysterious or suspicious in his own right. And Anderson fits into that vibe absolutely perfectly.
Right. I think it is so vital. And credit to Jeff, I think, on Survivor for being good in this respect as well. I think it is massively important that Anderson buys into the premise of the show to just the right degree, where he's totally willing to sell it to the audience and is plenty willing to be cagey with the players, but is never going so far overboard that it's comical. And actually, one thought that I had is I think you either have to find that kind of like perfect balance like Anderson does, or go just so far over the top, like on Whodunit. Was the guy's name Giles on Whodunit? The British butler host, I think.
Giles!
Yes, I think that worked really well. But anything in between those two would just be a disaster on a show like this.
I completely agree. And now that you've put that in my mind again, Whodunit is moving to the top of the rewatch list. That's a jump to the front of the queue. But I will say that I think Julie Chen would be a great host of The Mole, the great Julie Chen Moonves, and I maybe a lot more so than she is actually on Big Brother these days.
I like that take a lot, Dom.
Yeah, but that is the question, really, of how seriously should the show take itself, and it's a very delicate balance to strike, but I think Anderson Cooper here does a great job of it.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm sure we will have plenty more to say about Anderson as we go along this season. Let's dive into the cast of characters that we are going to be dealing with here. It is a game being played among 10 players, at least this time around. I'm not sure if that number ever changes over the course of Mole history, but we're going to go with 10 for here. Dom, I thought it was good, and not just interesting, I mean actively good, that as the Mole introduces us to the players and teaches us a little about their background, over the course of the entire season, they, on the Chiron, continue popping up people's occupation, which I know they do on Survivor, and I'm sure The Bachelor does this as well, and, you know, that's a standard thing, but for whatever reason, the difference between seeing whoever it... Carol, I'm struggling to come up with an example here. Say Sarah Lucina, it pops up and says police officer as her Chiron, versus Steven on this season says the undercover cop. I feel like defining them with the in front of their title as like actual characters almost within this kind of like mystery novel is really cool.
Yeah, the articles here are very definite. but it does stand out as we're introduced to this cast and we see all of their different ages. This is so far in the past now that even the youngest members on this cast are solidly in middle age now. Like, we have Afi, who's this college grad about to go to medical school. She's in her like early to mid-20s. She would be like 45 now, or I think like Jim and Catherine are the next. Or there's Henry, who's pretty young too. But even like Jim, who he seems so youthful, right? He has this incredibly young energy about him. He's 47 now. He's at a very different place in his life. And, you know, I guess that applies even more so for the older members of the cast, like Charlie and Kate and so on. Like, no one in this cast is the same person they were back then. And it's, I guess that's definitely true.
Charlie has not changed forever.
Charlie has not changed since like the 1970s. But outside of that, the general point remains that it's true for any season of a show that is this old, but it's just so weird to think about how far ago this was and how much must have changed with these people since then. Just how much, you know, how much of their lives they have lived, as weird as that sounds.
Yeah, we are making horrible time in getting there, but one of the tasks in this opening week features everyone with their personal kind of background information up on these big monitors, and they have to memorize everything about each other, and it's crazy. One of the categories is year that you graduated from high school, and it's so funny to see the youngest people in the cast, like Henry, it says graduated high school in 1995, and he's right. Like the young kid on the cast.
Well, another one of those categories is times that your heart has been broken, and I imagine a lot of hearts have been broken in the 20 years since this season first aired, although very impressively Charlie and Kate with a combined like 113 years of life between them, zero hearts broken, which is, I don't know how you live that long without that happening, but props to them, I suppose.
Strong stuff there.
I guess you either find it by marrying your high school sweetheart and never letting go, or never being open to the concept of love your entire life. So either way, you choose one of those two paths, maybe you get there, and you're safe and sound.
Both equally viable, I would say. I want to commend you, Dom. I thought this was going to be a season-long issue. I thought for sure you were going to come in here and pronounce Offie's name Affy. I was positive you were going to call her Affy.
Why? I always elongate my A's to the point where you make fun of that every time that comes up.
No, you always just reverse the A's from how people in America say it.
So Affy, Colin, are you're happy there?
No, that's good. I shouldn't have even said anything. I should have just let you keep doing it and played it cool. But I'm not that kind of guy, apparently. Let's get into our cast here. Let's start, I guess, with Affy, who is in her, I think, early mid-20s. She's a college graduate who is about to go to med school. She becomes known as the med school student, or just the med student. God damn it. I think I'm doing it myself now.
Do we have an official ruling on that one?
I think we'll go with the med student. She and Henry, who's 23, he's a bartender. Jim is 27-ish. I don't remember his exact age. He is the lawyer who I believe has a kind of interesting backstory. He was a lawyer turned helicopter pilot, which hopefully will lead to Dom saying helicopter at some point along the way in these podcasts. That's one of my favorite Dom words, but we'll save that for later, I hope. We have also Catherine here at 28, who is a law school lecturer who graduated second in her class at Stanford, but with only one or two exceptions, a pretty old cast, I would say, by the standards that we are used to watching Survivor and Big Brother.
Mm-hmm. It stands out even comparing this season of The Mole to, let's say, season 5, which airs in like 2008, I believe, where the craze of like going to bars in LA and looking for models really had not started yet in quite the same way. And so this season does feel like people you could just easily run into on the street or at work, much less so than some of the incredibly beautiful but and they know it, cast that you have on reality TV in 2020.
Yeah, the Mole casting in general, I would say, is not even comparable to casting for, it seems, in terms of what they were going for on The Mole compared to what they tend to be going for historically on Survivor and Big Brother. And I think that is with very good reason. So there are your people in the in their 20s. We have Steven at age 30, who is the undercover cop. We have Wendy, who whose exact age I didn't get. She's in her mid or late 30s. She's a visual display artist.
Hold on. I think she is, like, exactly 30. That's not that.
Oh, is she? I don't know. Whatever. We have Jennifer at 35 is the jock. She was a really acclaimed snowboarder. I guess decorated snowboarder would be the more accurate term, who is up to something else these days that I did not write down and can't remember. And then we have Manuel somewhere in his 40s, who's a single dad. Charlie is 63. He's a former NYPD cop. And then Kate is somewhere in her 50s. She is seemingly this Midwestern grandmother who is a Peace Corps volunteer. And Dom, a bit of exciting news on the Kate front that really took me by surprise, to say the least. The other day, I got word from someone who actually just recently became a patron. Big shout out to Noah, who said, "Hey, I saw you guys were about to roll into The Mole season one with the next patron rewatch. Perhaps worth noting, Kate from The Mole season one is my grandmother." So he has seen the season a bunch and has a very, I would imagine, clear access to Kate. So hopefully along the way, Dom, if we have questions that Kate could potentially shed some light on, that could be something that becomes a thing.
So I'm guessing the more likely explanation is that he heard we were about to do The Mole and then decided to sign up accordingly. But wouldn't it be cool if he just signed up on a whim and the thing that we happen to be talking about next was the season that just happened to feature his grandmother? I think that would be, that's what I'm choosing to believe now. That's my headcanon.
I'm not choosing to believe this, but I hope this is the case. I hope one of our listeners out there has the go-get-it-iveness to hear that we are about to do The Mole season one, sign up for Patreon and pretend that one of the contestants is their grandmother, knowing that we could never possibly look this up.
I would love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that could be exciting as well. So I did not calculate the average age, and I understand I rolled through this cast in a very weird way, but I would ballpark the average age at least 35 or so, which I think is interesting and probably good for a show like this. But
I don't know about that, but Charlie is doing a lot of work to drag that average up. I will say that it's like a bunch of people in, you've got some early 20s, we've got some late 20s, 30, 35, and then Charlie out there at 63, really representing the senior folk.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Kate's in her 50s, Manuel's in his 40s, Wendy's in her 70s or so, I would estimate. So, all right. I need to not do that. I need to not fire shots at these presumably very nice people who were kind enough to take part in the show many years ago. We have this kind of one-by-one arrival at whatever this launching point is. It's somewhere in the California desert. Everyone arrives, I think, by different modes of transportation. They get individual introductions, and they gather on something roughly equivalent to a Survivor mat that people gather on at the beginning of the challenges there. And Anderson comes in via chopper and welcomes everyone to The Mole, explains the basic fundamentals to them, and then says, "All right, it is immediately time for your first test here. Everyone is going to skydive from whatever it is, like 35,000, maybe not that high, from very high up. And if everyone does it, the group is going to win $75,000 for the pot," which, again, just the entire group earnings will all go to the eventual winner. "But if even one of you doesn't do it, then the group will get nothing." So right away, Dom, we have a pretty intense challenge here, I would say. You know, we just talked about this being a potentially older cast, perhaps slightly less inclined to go skydiving than your average CBS or MTV cast would be these days. What do you think about just this intro here and this opening test for The Mole Season 1?
What I think is that I will say helicopter as many times as you like if you continue to say chopper in that delightful New England twang of yours. But I love this marooning, if we want to, can we call it that?
Sure. Even though they're being the opposite of marooned, they are arriving via transport, you know, company provided transport.
That's the same thing as marooning. I'm sure that's going on behind the scenes anyway, but regardless, I really like this. I thought it was a good way to introduce a season and to test the mettle of the various contestants, where you could tell some of them they had not been skydiving before, and there was a good reason they had not been skydiving before. They would never voluntarily sign up for it, but that's what the situation called for, and they rose to the challenge, even though it was a little terrifying for them.
So right away, this would be something where I feel like at least on like level one kind of mole theory, you could make some pretty strong deductions in the event that someone were unwilling to do this. I feel like the mole would almost never want to draw that kind of attention to themselves this early on. And furthermore, I feel like the producers would not pick this as the opening task if they knew the mole was too genuinely terrified to do this, because it would draw such suspicion. So I feel like this is a situation where if I was one of the contestants in the game, I would anticipate the mole being someone very clearly willing to jump here.
Alternatively, to go back to your theory from before, what if the mole just made a big show of chickening out of the very first task?
That's what I'm saying. It'd be perfect. It'd be great. Yeah. I think we've solved the mole, Tom.
Yeah, well, if only these people had your wherewithal 20 years ago, this could have been a completely different season.
No, I seriously feel like the quickest way to get off of people's radar is to make a big production about how scared you are of jumping here. But skydiving, I think, is a good illustration of the general kind of thing that the mole wants to be doing here, which is putting people in positions where they can justifiably get out of performing whatever the test is, because it is vital, I think, for the game to balance the number of people who could at least conceivably be the mole for as long as possible. So providing people with justifiable ways of declining whatever the task of the day is, I think, is generally a good thing for the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so we end up with the whole group jumping. There is a brief slow roll there. We have Charlie and Jennifer as the last two to jump, and I think just because of where the airplane was or something went into it, they end up having to land a slight distance away from the rest of the group, and there is some sort of question of whether or not they did indeed jump, but everything ends up going smoothly there, and so we are going to fly from California all the way to Paris to begin the game itself. And right away, Dom, they do something that I love. And unfortunately, I don't feel like there were a ton more instances of things like this on this particular season, although if memory serves, which it very easily may not, I feel like they did more of this on The Mole 2. They offer the players the following twist. They say, you guys can go out and enjoy Paris, but you all have to be back by midnight or else you're going to lose $10,000 from the $75,000 that you earned earlier today. And so this provides at least an opportunity for people to, as we'll see from Manuel here, says, hey, how often are we going to be in Paris? Let's just lose the $10,000 and go out and enjoy ourselves tonight. When are we going to get this opportunity again? And even though the group ends up declining that option because they don't want to lose the $10,000, they don't want to risk the idea of even one of them coming back after curfew, I do think this sort of thing being part of the game is awesome. These small things where they can lose compared to what they earn in successful tasks, relatively insignificant portions of the pot, but just little things that can chip away at the earnings and draw suspicion onto people.
Yeah, and the answer right now to how often do you get to go out in Paris for a night is possibly never again. So you can see why Manuel was so excited to do that. But especially as he's someone who, you know, with his life situation and his profession, he's not going to get the chance to just travel to Europe on a lark every summer, right? Like, he, for him, this is a genuinely life-changing experience, even if that experience only lasts for a few days.
Right. So they, as I said, they end up declining the option to even go out in Paris just to, I think, avoid the risk of anyone costing them $10,000. But these sorts of things, I think, are really good for the show. And I don't know if we are going to have one this episode, but I also just love about The Mole in general, and I think it would be worth flagging up in the premiere. This is not a situation like The Genius or like Big Brother, where there's a sort of a set schedule for what's going to happen at what time. On The Mole, they routinely will be fast asleep and they'll get woken up to do some sort of test, or they'll think they're going to a group dinner and it will secretly be some sort of test, or something will get sprung on them. The game is afoot 24/7 in The Mole, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, if you ever have any kind of expectation, it's almost guaranteed to be subverted in some way.
Yes. All right. So I guess let's get into it's not so much a test, but just an interesting thing they do to mess with the players, which they are fans of doing as producers. They split the 10 people into two different vans to transport them from whatever, the restaurant back to the place that they're staying. And the first van goes straight to the hotel or whatever. And the second van gets held up and told, hey, there's not enough room for everyone's luggage. So what we have here are all 10 suitcases that you guys packed. And the five of you are going to repack not only your things into your much smaller suitcases that we're going to give you for the rest of the game, but you each get to repack for someone in the other van as well, which I thought, what, does this lead to, am I forgetting something this leads to, or is this just a fun way of meddling with people?
It leads to arguments, if that's what you're
sure.
getting to.
Yeah, we see Charlie, the 63-year-old former NYPD cop, has the brilliant space-saving technique when packing. It's Steven's bag, I guess. He decides that the efficient way of packing it is to only give him one shoe. That'll really save up some space.
This is exactly the kind of thing that I would do on The Mole, which is do something just horrifically incompetent entirely by accident, but in process draw suspicion to myself, which is the correct thing to do if you're playing The Mole, and then later I would pass it off as an act of genius that was meant to, you know, lead people astray.
Mm-hmm. You would be a good mole, Dom, I think. It's very difficult to get a read on you.
If I was on a cast with you, though, you would just peg me as The Mole from day one and stick with it the whole way through, regardless of my actual behavior or status in the game. You know, you'd be like, there's something shifty about him. I think he's The Mole, and just pummel that as hard as you could.
I think
you would blow up my spot.
I would know that you would not agree to do the show if you were actually in any jeopardy of embarrassing yourself. I would know you would only sign on
good
if
read.
You were
good
the
read.
Mole and were guaranteed to be in every episode and had nothing at stake.
You're really piercing straight to my core here. I'm not sure I like it.
The hour that we are recording this is pretty ridiculous without going into too much detail there. So the raw stuff is really coming out this time of night, Dom.
Time has never been a flatter circle than it is right now. So let's all bear that in mind.
That is very true. So that was a lot of fun, having just half the group repack for, at this point, what are still essentially strangers to them. I don't know too much about the behind the scenes of the casting process, but I would guess they weren't allowed to talk too much before the game began, and it's still only day one or two or whatever. And with that in mind, Dom, the second test is one we alluded to a little earlier. All 10 of them are going to have like an individual monitor with 7 or 8 pieces of like personal information displayed on there, and the goal is for each of them to memorize as much as they can. And with $50,000 on the line, the way this test is going to work is the group is going to elect two captains who feel like they remember the most about what everyone just got to see. And those two captains are going to be quizzed on various pieces of that information and use those numbers that they ultimately arrive at to get some four-digit PIN code, at which point they then have to find an ATM, a specific ATM, in whatever French town they are currently in now, and they are able to, these two captains are able to, if they feel like they need it, enlist help from the other players who were not selected to participate in this portion, but it costs them money out of the amount that they are able to, or actually, I don't know if it costs them, I think they have a two-hour time limit, and I think it costs them time if they want to get mm-hmm. help from someone to, like, double-check one of the answers that they're not too sure about. So the way this plays out is it seems like they're very quick with getting what they think, at least, are the right numbers, and the big issue is going to be finding the ATM, and their plan to make this go a little more smoothly is to and by the way, I should note that Catherine and Afi are going to be the people selected as captains, which I don't know if I had mentioned yet, but Catherine and Afi cruise through the numbers and then decide they want to get Jim's help to get to the ATM, because Jim is the person out of this cast who speaks French, which is quite useful when you are in France, Dom. So I guess let's start with, what do you think about the design of this test where two people are really the shot callers?
It's a little odd to me because it isolates all of them from the rest of the cast. And it's not like so many challenges in the future on this season and in other more seasons, you have two teams doing two different things, basically. And so the selection of captains is important, not just for their role as captains, but because it determines who's on which team and who does what task and so on and so forth. In this one, though, you have Catherine, Afi, and Jim doing their thing, and then the others are just kind of left talking at the hotel. Like they don't have a defined role. So maybe that's okay in week one to kind of like draw attention to some people and not to others, but it does mean that the people who aren't in that group that's highlighted, you just don't really get a good sense of who they are yet, and they have no role to play in the game.
I would anticipate, based on the way this played out, where we will see Catherine and Afi are, I believe, correct on every single number in their first go-through. And the drama really comes down to whether or not Afi and Jim will be able to go and find the ATM in time. And Catherine is there at the battle station in case they need to adjust the numbers. And you are right that apart from these three people, the other seven are just sitting around a dinner table waiting to potentially be called in the event that the captains need help. But I would guess the producers did not anticipate it being this easy for the people remembering the numbers, and thought that it would be a situation where more than one person would be called in and be involved in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But as it will play out, Jim will eventually get them to the right ATM, and the first shot at the PIN code does indeed turn out to be correct. So right away, the group has won $75,000 for the skydiving and $50,000 for this task. However, Dominic, and this I thought was very cool as well, another kind of small way for either the group to mess up unintentionally or for the mole to do some subtle sabotage. Anderson did say when he led the seven who were not captains and not Jim into the waiting room, he said, "You guys can talk about whatever you want. However, you cannot talk about any of the information that was up on the screen, because the point is you had your study time. You can't now just be refreshing each other on everything you just saw." And along the way here, we see someone, I think it's Kate, it's Wendy, gets a $10,000 penalty for the group when she asks Charlie about never having had his heart broken, and Charlie confirms that that was indeed his answer. Anderson, once the test is over, rolls the tape back for them and says the $50,000 just became $40,000. So I very much like that kind of caveat in tests like these.
It's the perfect small thing which would be so easy to sincerely mess up.
Right.
But if you were the mole, this is the best way to slowly bleed money out of the pot. It's to violate some restriction, which most people would have forgot was even in place, or would maybe have not have taken that seriously, and then just play it off as, oh shit, I'm so sorry, guys, after the fact. And it's suspicious, but it's also believable at the same time, and that's the perfect, like, ambiguity to have hanging over things.
Absolutely. And then a final very interesting note I would say here, when the way this test works is you have 2 hours to withdraw 500 French francs from this ATM, and they accomplish the task. And so at this point, Afi and Jim are at the ATM, and they've been communicating with only Catherine via phone as they're doing all of these things. And the three of them know that, okay, we have just successfully completed the mission in time. Afi and Jim come up with this idea about seeing if they can kind of hold the money hostage from the group. It doesn't say anywhere in the rules, as Afi points out, that we can't negotiate with Anderson for exemptions here. And what an exemption is on the mole is essentially like individual immunity. Along the way, people are going to have opportunities to earn exemptions where if they do something that will harm the whole group, they personally will be safe for the round. So Afi and Jim come up with this plan where they are going to say to the group, we only get the money if the three of us who did this task all get exemptions from this first quiz that we're about to do. And interestingly, they run it by Anderson before anyone in the big group that's just been hanging out waiting to find out what's going on gets wind of any of this. But Anderson shuts it down and then blows up their spot immediately when they get back to the big group and tries to ask them to answer for their attempted sins.
Yeah, and I don't know how you would come down on this based on your version of the game purity argument when it comes to various survivor twists, but I kind of hate this from Anderson, and I want you to talk me off the ledge here and explain what I'm missing.
I don't know how to feel about this, and similar, there's another exemption-related situation later where a player does something at thinking that they are still potentially able to get an exemption when time, when the window for that has closed, and Anderson does not let that go. He does make them explain to the group why they were behaving the way that they were, even though it wouldn't have mattered if they had gotten away with it. But I definitely see what you're saying, that he doesn't necessarily have to bring this up. At the same time, given that this is season one, episode one, first of all, you of course cannot grant them this exemption under any circumstances, and I'm not at all going to give Anderson a hard time for feeling like it's fair game to bring this sort of thing up. We've never done this show before. Who's to say, you know, if we can't say, hey, we should be allowed to, you know, it doesn't say anywhere you can't negotiate for exemptions. It also doesn't say anywhere Anderson can't blow your spot up for trying to negotiate for exemptions.
Okay, this is where we come into conflict, because I think they could and maybe even should be granted these exemptions, or at least should be able to bargain for it in that way. Because, as you say, this is season one of the show. There isn't any clearly defined precedent yet, and I like the idea of these creative players, including Jim, who, if this works, is going to be more emboldened to try all manner of crazy bullshit down the line. I want those players to feel like they can try something sneaky and get away with it, and that adds this overall sense of suspicion and ambiguity around the mole, where like if I'm doing something for my own personal advancement, right, I'm really aggressively shooting to get an exemption or just shooting angles in general, that's gonna put my name in the mix. But then also that's kind of what you want people to do anyway, right? So I would love to see people just like coming out with these really creative and wacky lies to try and secure safety for themselves, which in the process will make people think they're more likely to be the mole, which makes the entire show more successful, because then there's a question of who the mole really is, and it's harder to answer that. And I know, I would just really love to see that be a bigger part of the game. And I think they almost acknowledge this, because when, not to make a bunch of season five comparisons, but that is the season I've just finished watching, there are lots of times in that season where one person or several people is given the chance to kind of like break away from the group for an exemption, or to do something underhanded for an exemption, and that becomes this recurring storyline. And if people can manufacture those storylines for themselves, then I think the show is a lot better off for it. But even if you disagree with that, or if they disagree in this case, I think Anderson blowing up their spot to the group is massively harmful in terms of people trying these creative things. It's almost like the Topaz HOH room reveal in BB Can 1, where the moment that that becomes something that is kosher in the minds of the show, there is no chance anyone's going to take that risk ever again. And that just stamps on any creativity on the parts of the contestants.
I definitely understand what you're saying there, that it is, in a way, potentially discouraging people from taking creative lines later on if they feel like not only is it not going to work, it's going to actively hinder me in my standing within the group. That being said, three exemptions from the very first quiz, no chance that is happening.
He's not going to say yes, but I think they should feel willing and able to ask, is my point. And
I agree with that. And I would be sorry, continue.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think this timeline that I've constructed, where people can make these really ballsy plays and offers, makes the role of the mole that much more interesting too. Because as it stands, there is a strong incentive for the mole to just stay in like the Amanda position, right, in Survivor, where they are good at the task but not too good, and they're kind of good enough at anything to avoid any real suspicion, where it's never the person you most suspect and it's never the person you least suspect. And a lot of people don't get to that third stage of maybe it's the person I kind of middle most suspect. But that's the right way to play the mole at the moment. Whereas if you change this metagame to where you should be making these wacky maneuvers as often as you can, then the mole becomes incentivized to do that too. And so you get a much more interesting show all around.
So I definitely agree that being able to have some creativity and flexibility and room for negotiation is very good. And I have not watched season two of The Mole in close to 20 years, but I definitely remember a spot along the way where it's not an exemption, but during one of the tests, one of the players is like complaining to Anderson about how hard it is and says, "Oh, this is impossible." And Anderson says, "I'll bet you $10,000 out of the pot that I can do it." And so this sort of thing, I think, is something they remain open to. It's just the idea of three exemptions is insane. And I would, as the producers, not want to open the door for every single test becoming, okay, they won the prize, now we have to go do the negotiation as well. I think that can get somewhat murky. But I would have been very interested in the idea of Anderson potentially coming back with like a counter offer of, you will not all three get exemptions, but we're willing to play ball here. We do want to establish this as a show where this sort of thing can go down. So if you guys can land on just one of you to get an exemption in exchange for the group getting no money, then we'll do that.
You can scale it back if it becomes too much, and you can put your foot down and draw clearer boundaries if it becomes excessive. But I almost feel like that's a good problem to have. If people are pushing the envelope as far as they can, that's a sign that you found a good cast, you found a good group of people to play this game with. And yeah, in season two, there is a lot more like back and forth involving Anderson, and he becomes more involved in the show as opposed to just this host whose job it is to almost remain that distant.
Right. Okay, so my one other note, they are going to be shut down by Anderson and just get the money for winning the test. My one other note that I thought was worth bringing up from this first episode is Steven here. I believe it is only in this episode. He is rocking a baseball hat that just says "Hippies Smell," which I thought was so funny in the year 2000 to want to go on national TV just rocking the "Hippies Smell" baseball hat. And then for the remainder of his time on this season, Steven's hat becomes a Colorado Rockies hat from episode two forward, I believe.
Up there with the fucking pumpkin t-shirt in terms of weird RTV attire. But the whole just like the "Hippie Smell" thing, I feel like that would even be dated back in the year 2000. Like, that's a very 80s RNC kind of hat to wear. And looking at back on it now in 2020, it feels like, do Gen Xers these days even know what a hippie is? They know what a hipster is, which is a whole different concept, basically. But I don't know if the idea of a hippie even has any cultural significance anymore.
I mean, I think Stephen, who was 30 in the year 2000, and is, I suppose, a Gen Xer himself, is referring to the hippies of his own generation. The kind of, I think this is a response to the people who in real time were listening to a bunch of like Phish or whatever. Maybe the grunge scene was getting involved in that judgment by him as well. I feel like this was not lean years for people who may not smell great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. Probably spent more time on that than we needed to, but thought that was pretty funny there. So we are now going to get to our first execution, Dom. Yes, they call it an execution repeatedly all season long, I think all franchise long, which still sounds a bit harsh to me.
Yeah, this is the show kind of like taking yourself so seriously that it becomes less serious, maybe. Whereas, like, it's not an execution. They're going home to their family, although they do their best at the end to treat this like it is an execution, you know? They're almost giving this eulogy to Manuel after he fails the quiz.
Yeah, we need a name for that segment. We're going to lose Manuel here in this first quiz. And right away, I had no memory of this, but it became one of my favorite things, almost entirely ironically. There was rarely anything, I guess, of value in these parting thoughts. But as soon as someone loses on the quiz, they pack, I guess they just grab their already packed bag and go meet Anderson, who is going to take them to the car that's going to drive them away. And as they're getting ready to do that, the remaining players who all just survived the quiz give these like brief parting thoughts on the player that they just lost and everything that they're going to miss about them. And it's so funny to think about, like, this is literally being done moments after all of these people just went through this terrifying thing that they've been dreading for 3 days, and now they have to like turn on the enthusiasm and well-wishing and fond memories.
This is what the Survivor rite of passage always wanted to be, right? Like this bizarrely maudlin segment for people who in Manuel's case you've only known for like 3 days. It's like even like the best person in the world is not going to have that strong of a connection with you after that time.
Right. I think it would be worth getting into quickly just the mechanism for these executions. You know, they take the quiz, which I believe is generally 20 questions, and then the final quiz is longer than that. And whoever scores the lowest is executed. I forgot how much I love these thumbprints, Dom. The way it works is after everyone has taken the quiz, the group all gathers back together, and Anderson sits in front of a laptop with a monitor next to him with a gray background thumbprint, or some basic kind of background thumbprint. One at a time, he puts people's names into the computer. There is a very dramatic pause, and then if they are safe, the background will become green and they get the green thumbprint. And if they are the eliminated player, they get the dramatic music and the red thumbprint. And it is so intense every time, especially for me when I was rewatching this season. I had not even thought about the Mole season one in decades at this point in terms of these specifics. I knew for sure who the Mole was. I definitely remembered who the two people in the finals were, and I remembered that Manuel was the first elimination. I remembered nothing about the boot order in between, so I was genuinely sweating out every one of these executions as I was rewatching. It was so intense.
This method is, it's so incredibly simple, but that's what makes it effective, and it's the perfect choice for a show like this, which is trying not to be too, like, highfalutin or make too big of a production out of things, but it still has just the right energy for this ceremony. I really like that choice.
Yeah, and Anderson, in only this case, does the players' names alphabetically in terms of entering them into the computer, but even though it makes obviously absolutely no difference in terms of who's going to be eliminated, I love that going forward, the players get to essentially determine their own order for when they want to be entered into the computer.
I like that too, although for someone of my disposition, it makes me think about, is there some kind of like timing tell in terms of when they would want the eviction to come up in the order or whatever, whereas if it's alphabetical, that decision is out of your hands, right?
Genuinely, I have a timing tell on this.
Okay, but what is it? Or is that better safe for the spoiler zone?
No, it's a general kind of thing, because I would certainly be a person who, if I were genuinely nervous about whether I was going to survive or not, I would for sure be the first one with my hand raised every time. I would want to just know and get it over with, but it would never cross my mind if I was the mole. And generally speaking, I would feel like that would be one of the spots where you could get a decent read on people, is Anderson asking who wants to go first and seeing who desperately wants to find out whether they're going to make it or not.
I had not even thought about it like that, but you're seeing all the angles there.
Yeah. All right. So we end up, as mentioned, with Manuel getting the dreaded red thumbprint this week. And as he's being ushered into the escalator or whatever by Anderson, it's such a small, dumb thing, but I found it so funny that Anderson said, "Hey, thanks for participating. You played a great game." Seems pretty debatable to me that Manuel played a great game, but I guess what else are you going to say to the guy? And he seemed like a cool dude.
If everyone's playing a great game, then no one's playing a great game. It kind of takes the message out of it.
One kind of quiz theory question I had for you early on, when it's, I guess, let's take, for example, the literal first quiz. You're never going to have less information about who the mole would be. I would imagine you're never going to feel less confident about which direction to go with your answers. Would you be mixing between several candidates, assuming there wasn't one just like glaring person standing out to you? Or would you feel like the better move is to go for one person and hope that you're not just way off?
This is a good chance to dive deep into the quiz itself, which is this defining feature of the show, and seems either not that well thought through, or if it is, that's not shown to us. It's kind of like the question of whether the mole gets paid based on their performance, where you really need to know how the quiz works to make proper sense of anything that's going on, and yet we are never told that explicitly. But to answer your question, I think on the first vote, there's going to be someone in the cast who just hasn't really been paying that close attention, or is going to get something like stupendously wrong. So I think balancing your range among a bunch of different candidates is the way to go, because one thing that becomes evident quite quickly is there is no reward for doing well on the quiz other than survival in the early stages. It's not like you get more money in like a personal side part. You don't get any advantage in the game itself. You don't even get the public recognition of having done well on the quiz. The only thing that matters is not being the worst, which is understandable in terms of wanting to keep this simple. But I have to think that if there was some kind of reward for first or for something else, that's another interesting way for the mole to either blend into the pack, or for individual contestants to try and, I guess, define their own role and put themselves apart from the pack. So the absence of that is pretty weird to me. But for this specific thing, I think, yeah, you just answer as safely as possible among a bunch of different people and hope that someone else just fucks up massively, which week one is pretty likely.
I definitely love the idea of there being some kind of reward for doing the best on the quiz. The problem is that gives you such a clear idea that your answers are generally right and you know
that's fair.
Whom to focus. And it also, I would say, presents the issue of how to balance the mole themselves in you know, it'd be ridiculous if they were obviously getting every question right because they knew every answer about themselves.
Yeah, but, okay. On second thought, maybe this is a bad idea. But yeah.
I agree with your general takeaway there, especially early on. I think later into the game, no question, the clear move is to go all in, especially I feel like just in realistic terms, an observant person will be able to figure out the mole by at least 2/3 of the way through the game, I would say, or have a very strong idea of the best bet for those final quizzes. But yeah, I'm totally with you that in these early quizzes, I would be trying to narrow it down. I would probably be thinking in terms of who is not the mole, would be the big question on my mind during the early days, and trying to hit as many mole candidates as I can with each of the answers on the quiz along the way. But yeah, on a 20 question quiz that 9 of us are taking and are 9 of us are in jeopardy of being eliminated as we're taking, I would feel pretty good about a fast 6 or 7 out of 20 being almost certainly good enough to get through, with time being the tiebreaker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the quiz seems to be a mix of quite general questions, which could pertain to any number of people. So stuff like if the team is divided into two groups for a task, is which team was the mole in for this round, as well as things which are individual answers, but which overlap for a bunch of different people. So how many times has their heart been broken, for instance, where like there are a lot of twos, a few zeros, a few ones, and then like Jennifer is the 1-3, which makes sense. I can believe that. And then very specific individual questions. So not just who is the mole at the end, but stuff like what is the mole's age, or which position was the mole standing in for this part of a task, or something like that. And for that last group, that has to be binary, right? It's either you get that question right or you don't. I don't think there's any partial grading there.
I would imagine so. And that's the thing, is many of the questions are often, especially later in the game, just rewording the question, who is the mole? And you get to decide what frequency mm-hmm. you want to go with which person.
Yeah, it quickly warps into this repetition of, I have to select a candidate because eventually there are too few people left for me to try and hedge or balance between different people. And then also, once you have an idea, so many of the questions are designed to where it's basically just, let's say I think Colin's a mole, as I want to do. Okay, which group is Colin in on this task? What's Colin's age? Who knows? What's Colin's star sign? How many times has Colin's heart been broken? Again, no one knows.
Do you know the answer to any of those questions?
So you're 32.
All right, we don't need to give the answers. I'm just asking if you know the answer.
Oh, I don't know. Possibly. But how many times has your heart been broken, Colin?
We don't need to give the answers, Dom.
Fine. Is there an answer? Whatever. But basically, the way that the quiz is set up, it feels like... So I'm trying to think through the implications of this, but when you have people who, as we see in this episode, declare early on, okay, I have a read and I'm sticking to it 100% for now until something big changes. If they're just answering every question as if it is this one person, making no attempt to hedge their bets at all, then if they're not eliminated on that first quiz, to what extent is that a big sign that they're on the right path? Because if it's not Colin, if it's, you know, Mike Bloom is actually the mole and I'm answering everything as if it's you, then are the early questions designed in such a way that I could take a swing and a miss and still survive? Or is it the fact that I'm still in the game suggests pretty strongly that I should just give the same answer for every subsequent quiz for the remainder of the mole?
Can't spell Mike Bloom without mole, just saying.
Facts.
Later in the game would definitely feel confident that my answers were going the right way if we were down to the midpoint and I was still surviving quiz after quiz if I was just gunning it on the same person. But I would imagine that many people in the history of the mole have survived the first quiz and gotten kind of false reinforcement that they were on the right track, when in reality they survived because they had a fast 3 out of 20 and someone else had a slow 3 out of 20 or something like that.
That's the other thing. You don't know how many other people are following the same approach as you. So if someone else also is convinced that you, Colin Stone, are the mole and answering every question with that in mind, but they do it slower, or they miss some of the more general broad questions and they just get a lower score than you, they can be out and you don't know that they're doing the same thing. So you might completely misinterpret that and put yourself on the wrong path.
Right. I would be very nervous about drawing any big conclusions based on surviving the quiz alone early into the game. But I, at least for me, I do feel like a lot of meaningful conclusions can be reached early on. And I think we do see people feel pretty good about some of their conclusions early on this season. Without getting to specifics, at the reunion, it is made clear that at least a couple of people had their candidate and they were just gunning for them from the beginning. So certainly plenty of other approaches being taken, and that's why I feel like the middle of the road, let's just not be eliminated. Given that we can't learn too much from surviving, no matter how we do it, let's make sure we survive.
Do you have any thoughts on just the general quiz design here? Like, what needs to be true for this quiz concept to work properly?
I don't have any major notes other than the one that I mentioned earlier of feeling like, maybe not in the very first quiz, but certainly later on, many of the questions are essentially just an alternative way of asking who is the mole, by asking which position was the mole at in this challenge, where every person was at a different position that all of us obviously remember. You are essentially just asking who is the mole in a different way. But I also understand that coming up with 20 questions a week about 2 or 3 different events from those couple of days is definitely going to be tough. And I also think it is good to give people the opportunity, if they want to be tactical about their quiz taking, the option to space out to kind of diversify their portfolio of suspicion.
Yeah, I don't have much confidence in how the quiz is designed, but I also don't have any good alternative suggestions. So
I think the quiz works well. Do you not think it works well?
I'm just carping from the sidelines here. I don't know if it works well, or it might be something which works well at its given purpose, but that purpose is chosen poorly. So I don't know. It just feels like for how important it is to fundamentally how the game operates, it's a very opaque process, and the glimpse we get inside it does not really instill us with confidence.
I agree with that, but I think that's largely necessary to maintain the larger system. If they start giving us specifics, the minute they start talking about who did well or poorly on the quiz, I feel like that tells you a ton about who is or is not the mole, or is or is not looking good to win.
It might be that as a TV, just for TV purposes, the quiz has to be this black box, right? And even if you get to peek inside it and it seems like it's well-designed or whatever, that is still ultimately less satisfying than just the quiz as an abstract concept, which at the end we go to the screens and one of the screens turns up red and this big dramatic finish and someone goes home. Like, that's the point that things are building towards, more so than... You really have to be some kind of nerd to care about the actual quiz design, right? Like, that's a very niche interest here.
Well, I certainly understand wanting to see more about the quiz and wanting to be able to track various things about the quiz and trends and who, in what percentage of people were answering in what way. But it returns me back to the one thing that I feel like is kind of the elephant in the room with the mole, that they do a good job of avoiding becoming an explicit thing on TV seasons. But with the quiz, if you start showing us too much about how people are answering, by the midpoint, we're going to have a very clear idea of who the bulk of people think is the mole.
Yeah.
Which is not where you want to be when that's a huge piece of keeping people tuned in.
Yeah, and as we get into the later episodes, we'll see them try to confront that challenge, and in the spoiler zone for those episodes, we'll see how effective that really was in the time. Like, when you're watching this back, how well do they keep up that sense of tension or suspicion when everyone in the game is kind of operating under the same assumptions?
Yeah, and let me say something that I definitely should have said the first time. I was critical of the mole becoming, generally speaking, I would imagine, on most seasons, kind of a known commodity as they're actually out there filming. And again, they do a good job of creating compelling TV for the end game, but I would guess at a certain point in many mole seasons, everyone on production knows that everyone in the game knows who the mole is, and it's kind of I just want to say,
yeah,
I don't think that's the mole's fault in virtually any of those cases. I think being the mole is a borderline impossible task, and the reason for that is one of the things we talked about before we even got into the specifics of this episode we just talked about, which is just the propensity for people to have and for others to be able to identify just these definingly citizen moments that could not be inauthentic. I feel like the mole, just by process of elimination, is not going to have that same kind of citizen resume halfway through the game, and that's just it for the observant people left in the game.
Supposedly, Anderson Cooper himself was kept in the dark as to the identity of the mole, and only a handful of select producers were let in on the identity of the mole. And I don't know how true that is. It might just be that's the official line and we can't really disprove it. But it would make sense insofar as it is so easy for even just one person working on staff to like inadvertently leak something about the mole. And once that happens, the entire game is compromised from that point if anyone picks up on it. So you have to keep a very tight lid on everything insofar as you can. But I do wonder if that second tier of production staff who are working on the show but don't know who the mole is, they don't know the answer to the central question. I wonder if they, like, how quickly they figure things out based on what everyone in the game knows and then also whatever privileged information they have access to themselves.
Yeah, I have no idea how many people actually knew, but I definitely think it was smart by them to keep that number small. And I got the vibe during the confessional sequence they did of everyone saying to the camera, could I be the mole? Well, you never know, in slightly different wording, that they felt, I thought that some of them came across like they definitely thought they were talking to camera operators who themselves did not know the answer to who the mole was. But I would say most importantly in there, what you just laid out, is Anderson not knowing. And I don't know if that's true or not, but at least for me, if I were a producer or if I were Anderson himself, I would be adamant about not knowing. I feel like it is absolutely vital that the host be clearly treating everyone the same with no inside information. And as great as Anderson is, there is just no one that I would feel comfortable with having that kind of knowledge and trying to run an unbiased show along the way. I feel like we would just be doubling the risk of not only the mole giving up their identity, but now Anderson giving up the mole's identity.
We have said for years on the show that if you're someone in the fan base who gets spoiled, you should not be participating in these discussions about the week-to-week episodes of the show, because no matter how strongly you might try to avoid it, and no matter how strongly you might believe yourself that you're good at avoiding it, you will leak something out. The tone of your discussion will be different, just as a matter of course. And we're confronting that issue ourselves right now, because that is the premise of analyzing the mole, with the way it's set up as a rewatch, where we want this to be accessible to people who, and as you said at the very top of the show, this might be a sizable portion of the audience who have not seen the mole before and who are going back and watching it with us for the first time. We want those people to be able to listen week to week without having to go back and binge it all after it's said and done and they've essentially forgotten what's happened in those early episodes. So for us, we know what's coming down the pipeline. We know who the mole is. We know who the winner is, and so on. And we have to avoid tipping our cap in that direction at all in this segment of the show. And we set up this spoiler zone that's going to come very shortly explicitly to be able to get into that with the mask off, basically. But that's not going to be easy for us. You know, that's a challenge that we're going to have to think about how to face. And for Anderson, who seems like the consummate professional in his job, and I'm sure many of the producers are as well, that's still something which you should not have to make that decision for yourself, right?
Right.
Anderson should not have to try and entertain those concerns while he's out there filming the show. He should just do the best job he can with the same information as everyone else, and then he gets to take part in the big reveal just like the rest of them.
Right. And I would hope that they would make it clear to the cast, Anderson does not know who the mole is, because even for me, like, just even when people who are spoiled on something do a good job, if I know that they are spoiled, I read into certain, even if they are not giving anything away, it is still just a tremendously uncomfortable thing for me to have to keep asking myself if they mean certain things by whatever, because I know that they have additional information, even if they aren't giving anything away in that moment. So
yeah, and likewise, I want people listening to this to be able to enjoy hearing us talk about the episode because we enjoy it, and not trying to like game us by thinking, well, if this person was the mole, would Dom really have said that? Like, I don't really want that to be a thing that's an aspect of our show. Although it might be fun to like explicitly dive into that from time to time, but as a general rule, I want to stay clear from that as far as I can.
Right. That, and that's how I essentially feel hearing spoiled people talk about anything, is constantly wondering, would they say this if they knew that this was even if it is completely irrelevant?
Yeah. And there were a few cases of in the reunion, someone mentioned this. They picked up a hint as to who might be the mole based on off-screen production information that as the audience, we would know nothing about. But for them, there was something to that behavior that made them wonder and like pointed them in a certain way. And I do wonder how much of any season of The Mole is influenced by that kind of thing, stuff which not only is kept from us, but has to be kept from us because either it's irrelevant and you don't want to show it, or it points out the identity of The Mole, in which case it's too blatant. And that ultimately is the tension of the show as a TV product. It's finding ways to conceal the identity of a central role in the show, understanding that that means you will have to cut out so much stuff that you would absolutely put on the show under any other circumstances.
Right. I think now may be the pertinent time to get into the spoiler zone and talk about this in a little more detail, with the liberty of being able to let it all fly. So if you have not seen the remainder of this season and you want to remain unspoiled, which I would highly recommend, now would be the time to tune out. And 6 hours, or I guess hopefully you've already seen the premiere by now, so 5 hours and 20 minutes from now, you can come back once you've seen the remainder of the season and check back in with us. But for the people who do know the full scoop or just don't care, I think now is the time where we can start talking about things openly, and hopefully I have kind of yada yada'd for long enough that anyone uninterested has tuned out by now. So final warning, full Mole season one spoilers incoming right now. Tune out. That was it. That was your last chance.
That's the drop. Yeah.
That was it. Dom, let's get into it. Let's talk about this premiere episode in terms of the Mole and everything that they were up to. Dom, I guess I'll give you the opportunity for I'm sure there are people who are listening to this point that don't care at all about being spoiled. So, Dom, give us the big reveal. Who is our mole this season?
So the mole this season is Catherine, which came as, by the end, did not really come as a surprise to me, but it also came as no surprise to some of the contestants in week one here.
Yes.
We see Charlie say that his quiz strategy is to just gun it for one mole candidate, and we discussed the risk of that. It turns out that person was Catherine, and that strategy serves him pretty well over the course of the season. And even though he had one or two opportunities along the way where his resolve wavered, he came back to Catherine, and that's who he stuck with. And then Kate, too, also says that she was locked in on Catherine from the first quiz. And then we're going to see them in a few episodes have that experience where the two of them are on the same team for a task, and that only heightened her suspicions even further. And it feels like everyone realized pretty quick that Catherine is someone who, she's not the person you most suspect, she's not the person you least suspect, but she is the person in the middle who, and this is the crucial part, I think, seems like someone who production could choose as a good mole.
Exactly.
She seems very competent in the role. And to, I guess, spoil, to have a nested spoiler zone for season 5, if you want that to remain safe and pure, I will continue this one continuous sentence for long enough that you get to log out or whatever. Stop
let me, before you spoil season 5, let me pre-spoil season 5. Don't worry about season 5. It's a, you're happy to just be spoiled on how it plays out.
Fair enough. But in that season, like, I was tainted coming in because I knew that Craig was a long-term figure, like either the winner or the mole. But by the time you got halfway through the season, you knew Craig would have to be the mole because there was literally no one else that production could trust and put their confidence in to be the mole, right? Like, you know Nicole isn't the mole because she's in open rebellion against production. You know Paul isn't the mole because he's just so hot-headed that there's no way you can give him clear instructions. I guess Mark could be the mole, but he seems too, like, wearing his heart on his sleeve to be in the mix. So it's really, I guess, Craig or Victoria by the very end, and it seems like it's always going to be Craig, and sure enough, it's Craig, right? And that's almost the disaster scenario in terms of keeping the mole's identity under wraps. So you want a cast which is balanced in terms of having a few different candidates, and I think this one is for the most part, but despite that, they all realized pretty quickly it just has to be Catherine.
Right. So that was something I definitely wanted to get into, and I wanted to save it for the spoiler zone because I wanted to be able to use specifics here. A big, big factor for me would be, all right, who would the producers trust to pull off this role for the duration of the season? And Catherine would definitely be a standout candidate there. As a quick reminder, she is the law school lecturer who was second in her class at Stanford. And I would say the other people that would really jump off the page to me in terms of, and maybe this is influenced by seeing a lot of them in the TV episodes, but I would feel like Catherine, Jim, and Steven would be the three that the producers would feel the most confident in, and Jim and Steven are going to be our two finalists here.
To what extent do you think there's any kind of Edric going on with not just the mole, but also the winner, and how do those two different strands of Edric interact over the season?
I have no real recollection of mole Edric being a thing, although I definitely do remember, particularly for season 5, that they would give clues, not just in the TV episodes, but in, like, promotional materials. They would feature clues about, like, the mole's identity. And I'm sure that there was rampant discussion in both respects in the forum days when people were talking about the mole, for sure.
Yeah, it's a little different with the mole because you have these explicit clues, which I'm going to go and say right now, these are not clues. Like, when we have the montage at the reunion, and it's like, okay, they lifted up Catherine's bag as if that's meant to be this definitive thing, or when the word mole has four letters in it, and the fourth person to arrive is Catherine, so that should have been a sign if you were paying attention. But,
like, this is, I mean, Dan Brown, take notes. This is some great stuff here.
That's the kind of nonsense which, if someone said it on a message board, you would think they were just being a complete idiot. And maybe that's the point, right? Maybe this is the best kind of clue you can insert into the show before it becomes too obvious to the sleuths out there. But these are not proper clues. Like, I know in a season of the UK Mole, they had this, I don't know, not an acrostic, but there was this thing where the host would give this opening spiel at the start of every episode. And if you took the first word of every one of those, it would be first words revealed that the mole is blank. And if you picked up on that, then I guess good for you. You hacked the show, you know who the mole is. But that's not a clue. And I don't think anyone watching at home should feel bad for not getting something like that. So you have the supposedly explicit clues like that, but then you also have just the general TV editing framework of, these are the long-term players, these are the people we need the audience to care about. How do we feature them? How do we make sure that the audience does build that connection over time? And with someone like Jim, it's pretty easy because Jim is just TV gold. He's an incredibly charismatic guy. great player of the mole, is likely to be there for the long run. You don't have, probably don't have to worry about losing him too early. Steven, on the other hand, is seemingly just devoid of any of that charisma, but also is just incredibly effective, the same way that Derek Lavasso was on Big Brother, same way that Undercover Cop seemed to be made for any kind of game like this. Aside from Charlie, I suppose, but you know, there's always one. Steven and Jim are like this odd couple where they're complete opposites, but they end up being one of the closest alliances in the game. And then the third person in that closest alliance is Catherine, and they end up being the final three. And Catherine is exactly what you would think of for a possible mole. She's like generally pretty measured and competent, but has these relatably human moments where things get to her, or she messes something up and feels bad about it. But outside of that, she just seems very competent, very normal, very human, and someone who could easily blend into any group or any situation, which is the exact criteria, as Charlie himself said, for being a good mole.
Right. So, I mean, Charlie explicitly lays out for the producers, Charlie, again, 63, former NYPD cop, he says, we used to train people to go undercover, and we would say, lay low, don't do anything to stand out, as like Catherine has blatantly been given those exact instructions.
Yeah, so when you look at this final three, you have one of the more interesting triads for my money in all of reality TV, where they're so different personality wise and yet they have this really interesting vibe and dynamic with each other. And so it's easy to harness that and make it and put that into play in the editing. But you know, is there, do you see early signs of them pushing things in a certain way, knowing, for example, that Steven is going to win the season?
Oh, editing wise, I would definitely say Steven came across potentially a lot better based on the hippie smell hat and the attitude of someone who would wear such a hat on national TV than I would imagine he potentially could have in non-winning timelines. But yeah,
Also, like when he at the reunion is explaining his win and what he did over the course of the season, he seems there's just something off about him. I don't know if you got the same thing, but it seems very like sinister in a way. But you get none of that over the season, where he seems like, okay, he's pretty chill, pretty quiet, but observant, and there's, you know, no one has a bad word to say about him.
So I'm gonna make a cold read here, Dom. I am going to guess that Steven is a poker player, and not just that, I would bet Steven is a good poker player. He has the demeanor of many very good poker players, and I am very surprised that they put him on TV. I think they liked the hook of having a literal undercover cop there to try to expose this double agent, and I think their problem was he was extremely good at that. And in thinking back through this, I would guess Steven had the easiest time out of any of these contestants, just because potentially largely due to that demeanor, where I think he did a much better job kind of balancing his range, and people remained suspicious of him for much longer than he remained suspicious of anyone other than Catherine. In thinking through the kind of sequence of events here and the boot order, I would not be surprised at all if Steven was pretty close to 100% that Catherine had to be the mole, with like seven people left in the game, just based on how good I would feel about an undercover cop and their ability to pick up on someone like Jim being authentic versus someone like Catherine being duplicitous. I would be shocked if there was much doubt in Steven's mind from the first 10 days forward.
Yeah, and I don't think it's any coincidence at all that Jim and Steven, as the two finalists, were the mole's closest friends in the game. And maybe that's a function of age, right? Like when you get down to the final six and it's Charlie and Kate, who are of a different generation, have both suspected Catherine from the start and don't really seem to get along all that well with her. And then also Jennifer, who's just, you know, Jennifer. Again, who else are you going to team up with other than Jim and Steven? But it makes a lot of sense to me. Like the fact that they did so well in the game, and the fact that they were both very close with the mole, and the mole seemed distraught about having to take money out of their hands, I'm sure was not a coincidence.
Right. I would guess, I don't know when this conversation happened, but somewhere along the way, the point that I remember is I think it was at like Final Four, Stephen and Catherine were traveling together on like their very, maybe it was Final Six, on their various, yeah, it was Final Six, in their various modes of shitty transportation. I am guessing, at least if I was in Stephen's shoes there, I would be using that day as an opportunity to have a serious conversation with Catherine about the reality of her being the mole and see how she reacts to that. Because if we're alone all day together, I will come out of this understanding where you are landing on me feeling like you have to be the mole. And I feel like right around there was probably the point where Stephen was at an enormous advantage compared to the rest of the cast between his degree of confidence in who the mole was based on process of elimination with everyone else remaining in the game and everyone else still feeling like it could at least potentially be him.
I wonder if Catherine was under instructions as well not to reveal that she was not getting paid for sabotage. So there was no actual incentive for her to sabotage, because if you know that she is just getting a stipend, it becomes so much more appealing to just, again, love bomb Catherine as much as you can so that she will maybe not even explicitly give you information, but just because she feels more comfortable with you, give more signs that she is the mole.
Yeah, I definitely could see that being the case. And we end up seeing that for, I think, the majority of the missions, especially when they're split up into small groups doing various tasks, one of Stephen or Jim, who form this coalition early on and share info with each other, one of the two of them is with Catherine at every possible point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the other thing that I wanted to get at, just in terms of how you could feel pretty good about someone not being the mole, that I think played a pretty big role in the end game, particularly in the case of Charlie, our old retired NYPD cop. I don't remember the exact point along the way, but there's some night in here, I think it's relatively early on, where Charlie has a bit too much to drink and says some things that he is maybe not eventually going to regret, but definitely should regret. And just generally speaking, over the course of several rounds here, engages with the other contestants in such a way that I feel like, one, the producers would obviously see coming, and that's probably why he's on the show, and two, conclusively rules him out of being the mole. And I also feel like not just Charlie with kind of rubbing people the wrong way, but also I got the vibe from Jennifer. Big time, that they would just never, ever rely on this person to be the mole. And when two of the people at the final six are in that mold, the non-mole mold, that makes the game a lot easier for the people who are balancing.
I don't know how well this comparison will resonate for many people, but again, the ones who it does resonate for will see exactly what I mean. She reminds me of like Joe from one of the UK Apprentice seasons, where clearly they're in there just for sabotage, but not in any official capacity. It's just because they are so abrasive and so annoying at every point and incompetent that, of course, you know, they're just their being there is going to lead to the downfall of any team they're on. And sure enough, that's basically what happens.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what else in terms of the spoiler zone do we want to get to from the beginning? I guess to quickly just double back, one other thing that I had written down here that I thought was worth flagging up. We will find out in the reunion, as you touched on briefly earlier, Dom, Charlie reveals that his strategy for the first quiz, and I think for pretty much every quiz, was to just gun it on one person, and we ultimately find out that he was just laser focused on Catherine from the beginning. May have deviated or opened his mind a bit in the middle at some point, but he was not alone. Kate seemed to be right away on to Catherine, and as mentioned, it seemed like Jim and Stephen and that coalition were focused on her very early as well. So I did think that was at least worth flagging up one more time, that it really does seem like an immensely uphill battle for anyone being the mole. And I feel like I've been kind of hard on people who have served as the mole in general, talking about how in most cases that I've seen, at a certain point, it becomes kind of like public info who the mole is. I want to again say, I really don't think that can be avoided in too many cases. And if it were avoided, it was probably because the mole just went crazily out of their way to not actually be a mole. Like, they would have to do, I don't even know what it would take for a mole to actually make it the entire way through. So I definitely don't want to make it sound like I'm giving Catherine or the producers too hard of a time. It just seems like in this sort of format, it is very, very difficult to avoid. And that is, unfortunately, I think more in play this season than will be clear on the TV episodes.
Yeah, I would give Catherine no grief at all from the way she handled the role, based on what we have access to. I think she did a bang up job.
Yeah. Okay. And so,
I will say, in this first episode, if you're eagle eyed looking for clues or just general signs that she could be the mole, nothing really to speak of in this premiere. You come out of this episode with strong first impressions of some people, maybe not a strong first impression of Catherine, and that's the way it ought to be.
Right. I think that is very much by design. So, I know there are some other people in this cast that we didn't touch on too much today. I'm sure we'll have plenty of time along the way. But Dom, I think that is going to wrap us up for the premiere. And I would furthermore say that we'll see how long we end up going in general for the non-premiere episodes. I'm now looking at the clock and we are well over 2 hours from just this one episode. I was going to say, going forward, we may be able to get through 2 episodes per podcast. I guess we will play that by ear, but I should be back very soon with at least episode 2, if not episodes 2 and 3. And again, this is only a 9-episode season, so a lot of really fun stuff to get to, but it shouldn't take too long, honestly. So very excited to be getting to all of the rest of what The Mole Season 1 has in store. I believe I am out of things to ramble about this week. Dom, anything else you want to put out there for the people?
I'm out to just to say that this has been a really fun season to rewatch, and so far a really fun season to talk about too. And I'm very glad with this choice that the people have encouraged us to make, and long may it continue.
Yeah, we went about twice as long as I thought we were going to end going.
It did continue very long, I suppose.
But, I mean, this is the good. I was ambiguous about the time of day that we were recording before we began this podcast at about 2:45 a.m. It's now a little after 5 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, in the post-corona world, I don't know if clocks even are relevant anymore, but I feel like this could potentially be our new thing, Dom, getting through a bunch of podcasting at these insane hours.
For sure. And yeah, I think most of the episodes will be a lot shorter than this. There's a lot less to talk about. We are not being introduced to a whole cast of people. And then also, we covered most of the big picture stuff in this episode. So with that out of the way, I think we can come under the 1 hour mark for most of the episodes going ahead. But definitely excited to dive into a bunch of those in the near future.
Yeah, I promise that getting through 9 episodes of The Mole will not take us 20 hours. All right, so that will do it for us this week. Since this is going up on the main feed as well, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. And if you would like to continue this mole journey with us, patreon.com/DomAndColin is the place to go. Thank you guys for making it through this entire thing and sticking with us 20 years after all of this actually played out on TV. We will talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.